Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
As these progressive people and ideas take root with everything that is allowed to pass, we change ourselves as people, and we find it much more difficult to fight when the next battle comes.
If I profess with loudest voice and clearest exposition every portion of the truth of God, except that little point which the world and the devil are at that moment attacking, I am not confessing Christ.
There is no one who has exclusive domain on original sin. We are all born with sin, and it's not limited to any one race.
For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. Those two words, for us, embody our Lutheran understanding of the blessed exchange that Christ was born and died for us, taking our place.
Radio operators, commercial and amateur alike, just love Issues Etc.
Most pro-lifers understand that it's a long haul. It is a battle where ground is gained by the inch and not by the yard or the mile. We understand that the fight is long and that the progress we make will be slow, but we pray that it would be steady in defense of the unborn. It's the incremental approach. It's forced upon us by the circumstances of our politics and our political system. We have to take the battle constantly in defense of the unborn and take what ground we can. There is another view in the pro-life community of the abolitionist view, which is all of that progress that has been made in defending the unborn, regulating abortion, and hemming abortion in on every side, state by state, is actually sinful compromise. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Monday afternoon, October the 4th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be defending pro-life incrementalism with Scott Klusendorf of Life Training Institute. A little bit later, Dr. Ken Cherb continues our series through the Old Testament in a church year. We'll talk about the return from exile there in the Old Testament. And then it's part 7 of our series on the theology of worship. We're going to talk about teaching that congregational singing to a congregation with Pastor Peter Bender of the Concordia Catechetical Academy. Joining us to defend pro-life incrementalism, Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute. He's author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture, and a recent column titled Saving Some, Standing for All, A Defense of Pro-Life Incrementalism. Scott, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Todd, as always.
What are the incrementalist and the abolitionist approaches to the abortion issue?
The abolitionist position says that we must immediately and without exception declare that abortion be abolished, and there must be no toleration for any exceptions whatsoever, and that any exceptions that are in the law, in other words, any pro-life incremental bills to date, such as parental consent, informed consent, forbidding tax dollars from being used for abortion, are simply sinful compromises that reject the authority of God and make us complicit in the murder of those children that are not saved by the incremental laws. The incrementalist position says that pro-lifers, because they lack the power to save all children, should do what they can to limit the evil of abortion insofar as possible, given the hand we've been dealt. That's, in essence, the difference between the two camps.
So what about a recent resolution from the Southern Baptist Convention on abortion concerns you?
Well, what concerns me about it is that it makes any hardworking pro-lifer who's been working to limit the evil of abortion, it makes them complicit in evil and makes them party to murder. The language of this SBC resolution is unmistakable. It says very clearly, and I'll just read what it says here, that all these incremental bills are, quote, regulatory guidelines for determining when, where, why, and how we may murder unborn children. This is really strong stuff. Todd, if this is true, if pro-lifers are indeed guilty of this, if they refuse to repent of it, they must be disfellowshipped from their Southern Baptist churches, because after all, churches can't tolerate people who willfully sustain themselves in sinful behavior.
Abolitionists say that the highest priority is obedience to God. I'm sure you would agree there. But that efforts to save unborn lives are always downstream from that obedience, therefore their absolutist position on abolition or nothing. How do you respond?
Well, first of all, that is not the world we live in. Christians have a moral obligation to limit evil and promote good insofar as possible. There is no way to live in this world and get perfected principle every time around. Todd, you're not going to get it with a political candidate. There will always be a flaw in a candidate. I don't care who she is, who he is, there will be flaws. And so as Christians, what we must do is promote the good and limit the evil insofar as possible. If we always say we will never do anything that is not 100% pure in practice and principle, then we're going to end up tolerating all kinds of evil that will brutalize innocent lives that could be saved had we acted to limit that evil.
You use the analogy of three governors on the issue of spousal abuse. Take us through that.
Well, imagine three governors. You've got Bob, you've got Abraham, and you've got Caleb. Bob has the votes to ban outright wife beating. In fact, he has got overwhelming support for that. He claims to oppose wife beating, but when he sent a bill that bans it outright, he insists on compromises. He insists that there be exceptions. And he says, for example, that young men under the age of 35 have not yet learned how to control their anger. So we've got to make an exception. They might explode and hit their wife if a meal is burned or if the kids aren't disciplined. And we just have to accept that reality. So he vetoes a bill that would protect all women. That's clearly evil, because he has the power to protect all women, but he won't do it. Now, let's contrast that with Abraham. Abraham is in a state where wife beating has been legal for decades. It's deeply entrenched. He does not have the power to ban it, but he gets to work immediately doing what he can to limit the evil. So he signs an executive order, for example, that says if you work in the state government and you're in an abusive relationship, you can leave that marriage without fear of legal reprisals and you'll keep your job. And let's assume that a couple of years later he gets a majority in the state house where his party, which more or less is opposed to wife beating, sends him a bill that says you can't hit your wife with a blunt instrument and you can't hit women over 50. Well, he wants to protect all women, but if he signs those two bills right there, 20,000 women in his state will be protected that night and will go to sleep with some protection that evening. So he signs those bills, but he keeps pressing for more. And even his political critics know he's going to do this. He's not resting on that as a final stopping point. He is doing what he can to limit the evil done, given he doesn't have the votes to ban all of it. And he keeps pushing and pushing until he gets that. Now let's look at Caleb. Caleb is like Abraham. He's in a state where there aren't votes to ban wife beating outright. So he gets a bill identical to what Abraham is sent. But he vetoes it on ground that he is not going to be complicit in the abuse of those women that are left unprotected, and that any incremental means of trying to limit the evil of wife beating is simply regulating when, where, how we may beat our wives. In the name of Christian purity, he vetoes it. Well, of course, that night, 20,000 women in his state go to bed unprotected. So which governor did the right thing? If you're an abolitionist, you say Caleb. If you're a pro-life incrementalist, you say Abraham.
So where do the incrementalists and the abolitionists' approaches, where do they agree, at least in principle?
Well, they agree in principle that we should protect all children, and if we have the ability to do it, we should do it right now without pausing. We agree on that principle. all human beings should be protected in law, including those in the womb, whatever their gestation, whatever the circumstances, and we agree on that principle. For example, a pro-lifer, an abolitionist, would agree that no one should say, well, in principle, we'll protect all children except those conceived through rape. Well, if that's your principle, it's a flawed principle. But where pro-lifers and abolitionists disagree is in practice. What do we do when we can't live out our principle the way we want to? Well, the abolitionist position is, well, you just declare that laws allowing abortion are null and void, and you refuse to acknowledge their having authority over the state. They're null and void. But the problem, of course, Todd, is that declaring a law null and void is very different from it being null and void. And this is where I think abolitionists make a mistake. They confuse moral authority with legal authority. As Christians, we agree God is the ultimate moral authority. God is the one who will make all humans answer to him on Judgment Day. But it doesn't follow that because God is the ultimate moral authority that Christians, by extension, have legal authority to get done all they wish to do eradicating evil. We need legal authority to abolish abortion. And so the pro-life incrementalist says, look, I'm going to do the greatest good I can, given the hand I've been dealt, and I'm going to keep working for that legal authority to line it up with God's moral authority.
So how do you respond to that particular assertion that the incrementalist approach leads to laws that merely regulate abortion and thereby at least implicitly sanction the evil of abortion?
Well, here's the thing, Todd. I am not consenting to the evil that I am powerless to control. And I'll give you an example of that. Suppose I'm a prisoner of war as a U.S. Army officer and enemy insurgents capture me and 500 of my men. And they take us on a brutal death march, and we're walking across the desert, and men are dropping like flies. And what happens is our enemies promptly shoot any man that falls behind. Well, let's assume as an officer, I am somehow able to secure a concession from my enemies that says, listen, men who drop from exhaustion, they get 20 minutes to start walking again before they get shot. Now, if I secure that concession from my enemy, am I consenting to the deaths of those men that can't recover, who don't get up? No, not at all. I'm not the one who set this situation up. I was given the evil situation. I was forced to work within it. I didn't choose it. I didn't consent to it. But by limiting the evil done, I did the best I could, given I was forced to negotiate from a position of weakness. Now, let's apply that to abortion. The Supreme Court and the federal courts, up to this date, have declared that no unborn child has a right to life. None. When we limit the evil of abortion, who is doing the concession? Who is doing the compromising? Not the pro-lifer. The other side is being forced to compromise their position, which is that no child has a right to life. So pro-lifers are not consenting to the death of any child that is left unprotected by a bill that doesn't ban all abortion. They would only be consenting to it if they had the power to protect all, but refuse to do it.
I have seen abolitionist apologists say that the incrementalist approach only tells you what someone thinks about abortion, whereas the abolitionist approach tells you what someone intends to do about abortion. And that struck me as somewhat ironic, given the fact that their position seems to outline doing nothing unless you can achieve an absolutely perfect end.
It does seem that way. In fact, more than one pro-life commentator has said that abolitionism can only succeed on the backs of babies that are relegated to the grave right now. If I can't save all children, do I really want to say we should let babies die that could have been saved with incremental legislation? For example, the Hyde Amendment saves lives, thousands of lives a year. The Hyde Amendment says you can't use federal tax dollars to promote abortion in federally funded clinics. Well, that saves lives. There are women who choose not to have abortion because of that. Does it save all unborn humans? Of course not. But do we really want to say we should let those children die whose lives could be saved through that incremental step in the service of a principle that we deem to be morally pure, and therefore we're going to stick to that principle even if it does cost children their lives?
Scott Klusendorf is our guest. We are talking about defending pro-life incrementalism. He's president of Life Training Institute. On the other side of the break, pragmatism. Some would say it's necessarily a compromise with evil. Is it? We'll be right back. Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. Simplyclassical.com.
Is your church celebrating a major anniversary soon? Ad Crucem can help with customized products to commemorate the event. We can create church banners, ornaments with an image of the church or your logo. We can even make stickers to hand out to members. We also recommend Kelly Schumacher create a painting of your church with matching greeting cards. Visit adcrucem.com and search for Church Anniversary for more details. That's adcrucem.com.
Defending pro-life incrementalism with Scott Klusendorf of Life Training Institute. I'm Todd Wilkin. Your link to Issues Etc. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life both in our church body and in the culture at large. You'll find free pro-life resources at lcms.org/life, advocating for the unborn, weak, and vulnerable. LCMS Life Ministry, lcms.org/life. Scott, we're really talking here about pragmatism. Now, is pragmatism necessarily a compromise with evil?
Well, it's true. Compromise can be related to pragmatism, but not always is it true that pragmatism is evil. It could be evil, Todd, if I justify wrongdoing with an appeal to pragmatism, like Governor Bob does. He says, look, young men will be young men, guys are going to be guys, and look, we got to accept the real world here, and we got to be pragmatic. They're going to beat their wives even if we tell them they can't. So let's, instead of making it illegal for them to beat their wives, let's provide federally funded counseling for men. Okay, that's an evil pragmatism. But pragmatism may also mean prudent. Now look at Governor Abraham. He doesn't have the votes to ban abuse outright, which is what he truly intends. but he does have them to protect 20,000 women right now by signing legislation that says you can't hit your wife with a blunt instrument, and if you're a state worker, we're going to protect you if you leave an abusive situation. He needs to do what he can to limit the evil done, and by doing that, his pragmatism is actually prudence. He's working within the restraints he's forced to work within to save as many lives as he can while he never gives up on his principles. By the way, his political enemies know he's going to keep coming back for more. Everybody knows that. And therefore, he's not like Bob, who says, my final resting point is a pragmatic resting point. I want to be a pragmatist and always have an exception for young men. That's not what Abraham is doing. Abraham is committed to the fight to do good. He's committed to protect all women, but along the way, he's going to save as many as he can.
What are some of the other faulty assumptions of the abolitionist's position?
The biggest one, I think, Todd, and let me tell you before I get to that, I do agree with their position that all children need to be protected. Like we said a moment ago, in principle, I'm with them. We're talking here about practice. What do we do in practice when we cannot fulfill that principle that we are committed to? And therefore, there is some agreement there. But here is the faulty thing that abolitionists bring to the table. They assume that pro-lifers have the power to end abortion right now, but simply won't. And that's simply not the case. We can't just wave a magic wand and make abortion go away. Like I said a moment ago, while God is the ultimate moral authority, we need legal authority to protect all unborn children, and we don't have that yet. Now, there is a hope that we might be making real progress that way coming up on December 1st, the Supreme Court is going to hear the Mississippi case that is a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Those are the two Supreme Court cases that make abortion a fundamental right at the federal level. And what will happen, or I should say a constitutional right, what will happen is the court more than likely, and I'm not the only one who feels this is a strong likelihood, the court more than likely is going to have to strike Roe and Casey to uphold the Mississippi law. There's really no way for them to uphold that law without striking Roe and Casey. If that happens, what will happen, Todd, is that the issue of abortion will be returned to individual states, and they will then decide what are the guidelines they're going to put in place. Now, of course, as pro-lifers, believing in the natural right to life of the unborn, we don't think the issue should be left to individual states in the final analysis. The federal government has a duty to protect the natural right to life of the unborn. But our situation will get better if Roe and Casey are struck down, because the current legal reality is that if a pro-life law is an undue burden to the woman, then the federal courts have been striking those laws down. If Casey and Roe go, that undue burden standard will also go, and that means states will have greater latitude to protect unborn humans.
How does the abolitionist position view the literal mountain of incremental pro-life legislation that has been accruing over the last 40-plus years since Roe? There has been tremendous state-by-state progress in terms of regulating abortion. How do they view all that?
It's a sinful compromise, quite frankly. And then some of them say that those laws haven't done any good at all. I mean, I've actually heard abolitionists say that those laws have not saved any lives. Okay, that is an indefensible claim. Now, there is a point, Todd, where we can have a prudence discussion about whether incremental laws are achieving what we hope they will achieve. That is a task, a discussion for fair-minded individuals to have a discussion about. I'm all for that. But the abolitionists are not making merely a prudential argument about effectiveness. They're saying it's wrong in principle to support these incremental laws, that they are sinful compromises, and that they all they do is regulate how, when, and where, and by what method you can use to intentionally kill an innocent human being. And I find that conclusion to be absurd.
You say that really all pro-lifers are, in the final analysis, incrementalists of some kind. What do you mean by that?
Well, even an abolitionist is. And here's why. Notice that abolitionists are trying to introduce abolitionist bills, meaning bills that ban abortion outright, in individual states rather than the country at large. Notice they're working incrementally. They're not going for the whole enchilada countrywide. They're introducing their legislation in individual states one at a time. Now, they've not succeeded anywhere, and it's unlikely they will without Roe and Casey falling. But notice that they are having to work incrementally. It's what Doug Wilson has called political incrementalism. We can't help but be incrementalist. It was right to abolish slavery in 1865, even though segregation was not banned until 1964. And Todd, even if we get rid of abortion, we still have the evil of in vitro fertilization embryos being destroyed in fertility clinics. We still have the evil of certain, not all, but certain assisted reproductive technologies that treat children as commodities. We will still have evil to deal with, but it's right to go ahead and get rid of the evil you can, given the political authority you have, and not wait until you have perfection on your side.
That raises the question of whether or not the abolitionist position has a real-world plan for abolition beyond just simply making declarations.
I don't think they do. I think that what they have done is they have basically said, we're going to stick to our principles, and that's what really matters here, not saving children. We are going to stick to our principles, even if it means children are not saved right now. And they say that because they believe that their principles are the highest good, but that's question begging, because the whole debate is really about, is it okay to save those lives we can while we wait for a time when our principles can be fully realized? That's the whole debate. And what we need to look at here is what happens in the real world right now without the reversal of Roe v. Wade and without the reversal of Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Let's say that a state defies Roe and Casey and passes an abolitionist bill. And let's say the governor, by some miracle, signs it. What happens then? Well, now you've got basically a declaration of secession. You've got a state that's saying we are going to reject what the federal authority is here, and we are going to deny that federal authority supersedes state authority, and we're going to ban abortion outright. Well, what's going to happen then is, in the absence of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey being overturned, you're going to have, more than likely, federal troops sent in, just like what happened when states tried to defy federal authority on segregation in the 1960s. You're going to have federal troops sent in to forcibly keep the clinics open. Now what? I mean, this leads to a terrible position of anarchy and destabilization that is not going to help save children nationally.
Finally, you said there that it was an issue of question begging, that is, assuming what you propose to prove. How does that apply here, Scott?
Well, when abolitionists say that incremental policies are immoral, they are, in essence, assuming what they're trying to prove, because you have to first make the case that these incremental policies are immoral before you simply assume that they're immoral. And that's what we mean by begging the question. They're assuming the very thing they are trying to prove.
Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute. He's author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture, and a recent column titled Saving Some, Standing for All, A Defense of Pro-Life Incrementalism. You can read it and learn more about Life Training Institute at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Scott, thanks.
Thank you, Todd.
Dr. Ken Cherub is with us on the other side of the break. We'll continue our series through the Old Testament in a church year, talking about the return from exile. Concordia Publishing House's annual warehouse sale is both online and in-store. Take advantage of discounted prices on many of the items you hear promoted on Issues Etc. October 15th through the 18th. You'll find major cost savings on books, music, Bibles, educational resources, and more. Concordia Publishing House's fall warehouse sale, cph.org/warehouse, and 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. Concordia Publishing House's warehouse sale, October 15th through the 18th.
Have you ever picked up a copy of the Book of Concord and been overwhelmed by it? There's a whole bunch of difficult names and documents and apologies and formula of concords and epitomes and solid declarations, and before you know it, you don't even know where you are in the book. Well, if you've had this question, you'll be interested in picking up the October issue of the Lutheran Witness, your reader's guide to the Book of Concord. To subscribe, visit cph.org/witness or learn more on the Lutheran Witness website, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your will, and us who rightly seat us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.